All right, good morning. How's everybody? Pretty good? Yeah, because, there's a week from today. There is your first lecture exam, right? So make sure you're on top of stuff. Hopefully you've been looking through the study guides. That's what the exam is based off of. And it lists what pages you have to read, what end of chapter questions you should know. And if you want to check your answers to the end of chapter questions, can you do that? Yeah, because where are the answers? At the back of the book, right? All the online questions will give you answers once you submit the quiz, right? Those you don't have to turn into me. And even the online quizzes come from the pre-lecture reading assignment, the online quizzes, sometimes maybe the back of the book quizzes, and all those have answers for you, right? So even your pre-lecture reading assignments. Do you find those pre-lecture reading assignments helpful to understanding lecture, those of you that do them? Does anybody do it? I heard yes. I heard a couple of faint yeses, a couple of loud yeses. So stay in tune with those pre-lecture reading assignments. They'll help you with lecture. And, of course, do you still have room in SI for students to new students to come? Is Crystal here? Yeah, there's Crystal. Do you still have room in SI?
Yeah, there's plenty of room.
You got plenty of room.
Oh.
Okay, fantastic. So there is still room in SI, so don't go because you think there's no room to go. There's plenty of room. Okay. All right, so we were going to finish up chapter 6 and then move into chapter 3, and we're going to cover chapter 3 this week. Chapter 3 is fortunately probably one of the easier chapters, and it might just look like a review to you from anatomy, so that's nice. The hardest chapter might be 6, has some new concepts in there. So let's finish up chapter 6. We're talking about cell signaling. Oh, there was a good joke I missed. Is it a really good joke? Or?
Chapter 2.
Oh, chapter 2?
Yes.
Chapter 2? Okay. Okay, see me after class. Anyway, we're going to finish up this this chapter right here. Okay, we were talking about how cells signal each other to control different aspects of your body, right? And what's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells so that cells can communicate with each other for regulatory purposes, for instance? What's that called? Structural and functional unit of communication between cells. It's called the synapse. Yeah, you're right. It's called the synapse. And you remember there are two different kinds of synapses. What are the things that get sent between the two cells that can cause the coordination of these group of cells? It could be a chemical, or it could be an electrical signal. So a chemical signal or an electrical signal. And if it's a chemical signal, then we call it a chemical synapse. If it's an electrical signal, then we call it an electrical synapse. And by far, the most important and the most ubiquitous are the chemical synapses. Right? There are very few electrical synapses, and that's what we were talking about last time. Electrical synapses are due to gap junctions between cells. And gap junctions is a special kind of connection between the plasma membrane between two neighboring cells. And it's built on these connexin proteins that build a tunnel between the cells. So as you have a high concentration of sodium building up in the top cell, what happens to sodium? As there's a high concentration in the top cell, it does? It diffuses into the bottom cell down over here. And what kind of molecule is sodium? It's an ion. Yeah, it has what? It's a monovalent cation. So you could think of it as a molecule moving across, but in reality, it is what? An electrical signal because it is an electrolyte. It's an ion. So that depolarizes the bottom cell, and so that would be an example of an electrical synapse due to these gap junctions right here. All right, here's an example of a chemical synapse. So here we have a tissue. And it's going to want to control maybe these muscles down over here. So it's going to release a chemical that diffuses through the extracellular space. And it's going to bump into these cells down over here. And it's going to change the behavior of these cells if these cells down over here have what? Okay, how can these cells be sensitive to these regulatory molecules or these paracrine regulators from this top layer of cells? They have to have they have to have a receptor, right. So these things are only target cells if they have a receptor for these molecules. And how would you, what would you use to explain the relationship between the signaling molecule and the receptor? Okay. The shape has to be right. All right. What, how would you describe the shape between the signaling molecule and its receptor? Okay, they have to be complementary, right? So that the signaling molecule can actually fit into the receptor so that it can bind. All right, and the receptor is very specific for a particularly shaped molecule. So one paracrine regulator won't bind to just any receptor in the body. It's got to bind to one that matches up perfectly in shape. All right, so what must be the shape of the binding site of the paracrine receptor down over here? It's got to be complementary, like the hand and glove kind of thing, or lock and key kind of model you could use to explain that. Okay, so here we have an interesting model for a chemical synapse. We have a neuron, and you can see dendrites right here, cell body, and an axon. And flowing down this axon is what kind of signal? An electrical signal, all right? But that electrical signal can't hop from the neuron into this muscle down over here. It's got to be converted into a chemical signal. That chemical is released from this axon terminus, and then it moves from high concentration near the axon terminus to low concentration by this muscle cell. And the muscle cell will then change its activity if it has a receptor for this molecule, right? And then the muscle cell, when it binds, then this muscle cell is going to contract. So here is a specific kind of chemical for chemical signaling, and it's called a neurotransmitter, right? Because this is a neuron that is transmitting a signal across the synapse to cause this muscle cell to contract. And at this point in time, it's probably not a bad idea for you to have an example on the tip of your tongue of what a particular kind of name of a neurotransmitter. There are various neurotransmitters that are used in the body. What's your favorite one? Acetylcholine is really good. Okay, what was another one? Somebody have another one? Serotonin, epinephrine. We're going to look at all these different kinds of neurotransmitters. All right, but so we see that the way that these two cells communicate with each other is that through the neuron, it is an electrical signal, and then that's converted to a chemical signal that moves and binds to the muscle, and then the muscle is excited because then that chemical signal is converted back into an electrical signal that flows over the whole muscle cell, causing it to contract. Okay, here's another kind of long-range and chemical signaling scheme. Here you have a gland, and we can see this is an endocrine gland. And the job of an endocrine gland is to synthesize and secrete hormones. And where do these hormones go? You could think of two ways, two things. It could go into the blood, or it could go into a duct, and then that duct delivers it to wherever it's going to go. But if it's an endocrine gland, where does this regulator go? It's picked up by the blood. So in this case, the circulatory system becomes the duct, and then we call that an endocrine gland, not an exocrine gland. So it goes in, the blood travels everywhere where the blood goes, which is most places in your body. It diffuses out through a capillary down its concentration gradient, and it's going to bump into millions or trillions of cells, and it may elicit a response in these cells or cause these cells to change their physiology. But what does a cell have in order for it to be sensitive to this signaling molecule? It's got to have a receptor once again. Right, and the shape of that receptor has to be complementary to the shape of the signaling molecule. And if it has a receptor, then we call this a target tissue. That's really a better way of saying target organ. Target organ is okay, but target tissue is a better way of thinking about it. Okay, so this would be another example of what kind of synapse, an electrical synapse or a chemical synapse? A chemical synapse, but this goes over a long distance. That's the only difference. Okay. Well, we could break down all signaling molecules into two general kinds of molecules, those that can be hydrophobic and those that are hydrophilic. All right, so if it's a hydrophobic regulatory molecule, what kind of barrier does this plasma membrane present for it? Not much, right? If it's hydrophobic, that means that it can diffuse through lipids very easily, and so a hydrophobic regulatory molecule can move through the plasma membrane. And so there don't have to be receptors on the surface of this plasma membrane because it can get inside the cell. But there has to be a receptor someplace, right? So here it is, inside the cell. It's a cytoplasmic receptor, and then this receptor is going to translocate into the nucleus and is going to signal the beginning of protein synthesis. And we call that transcription. So when a signaling molecule binds to a cytoplasmic receptor, we call that a transcription factor because it's going to start protein synthesis. And then those proteins are going to build up inside the cell, and that's going to change the physiology of the cell right here. Some examples of hydrophobic regulatory molecules would be steroid hormones. Anybody think of a name of a steroid hormone? What's your favorite one? Testosterone, absolutely, okay? And or you could think of estrogen, other kinds of steroid hormones, right? Thyroid hormones and also nitric oxide are compounds that can move through the plasma membrane. They're not excluded from the interior of the cell by the phospholipid bilayer right here. All right, now what about if a molecule is hydrophilic? Can a hydrophilic molecule move inside the cell? And if it's a signaling compound, okay, you all just said it can't move inside the cell, so where do the receptors for a hydrophilic regulatory molecule have to be? If it can't get inside the cell, it has to. Those receptors have to be on the extracellular surface. So here is a pretty good example, okay, of a receptor, a protein molecule embedded in the plasma membrane. These are floating around. And here is a signaling molecule coming from some distant location. It's going to bind to this receptor that's extracellular. And remember, this first messenger right here cannot get inside the cell. But when it binds, it's going to cause the production of another kind of signaling compound inside the cell. And those are what we call second messengers. These second messengers then will activate other proteins or produce other proteins that will then change the physiology of the cell. Or maybe it will open up ion channels, for instance, and it will allow ions to enter or leave the cell. And that changes the electrical properties of the cell and the physiology of the cell. So we got a couple of questions on this slide, just to kind of test your understanding, and that is, where do you always find first messengers? Outside the cell, because they can never get inside. Why can't they get inside the cell to change the physiology? Because they're hydrophilic, they can't get through the plasma membrane. And where do you always find second messengers? Inside the cell, right? And second messengers will form inside the cell only if there's a first messenger on the outside. All right, so the first messenger will cause the concentration of second messengers to increase inside the cell. So first messengers are always outside, second messengers are always inside. Right? Second messenger is still a regulatory molecule. This process of building regulatory molecules inside the cell from a signal that's trapped outside is what we call signal transduction. Oh, I'm glad I had that spelled out on your slide. Is it on your slides too? Good. Okay, so I had to modify this one, put it in there. Signal transduction, and that confused people for a really long time. Okay, we knew that there were hormones, for instance, that would cause changes inside the cell, but we knew those hormones were trapped outside the cell. And it was a huge question for a long time. How does that signaling molecule that's trapped on the outside actually make changes on the inside of a cell? All right, and there are a couple of people in 1994 that got a really nifty Nobel Prize for that. All right, which we're going to look at on the next slide. So here are some second messengers. All right, some second messengers can be a calcium. All right, where do you usually have a high calcium concentration, a calcium ion concentration? Is it inside or outside the cell? Okay, that's in this chapter. That's one of the things I said, oh, you got to know at least what these four or five ions, where are they found normally high concentration. And calcium is usually high outside the cell. Okay, so it's normally high outside the cell, but if for some reason it starts to build up inside the cell, that's a signal for changing the physiology inside of that cell. So it can be a second messenger when it enters the cell or it's released within the cell. Cyclic AMP is a breakdown product of ATP. That's maybe the wrong way of thinking about it. The precursor molecule is ATP, and a special enzyme can take ATP and make cyclic AMP out of it, right? And that can be an important second messenger. G proteins, which we're going to look at, I think, in the next slide, can be second messengers. Something called diacylglycerate, that we're just going to call it DAG, right, will build up inside the cell, and then inositol 3-phosphate, we're just going to call that IPI3. When that builds up inside the cell, that's also going to change the physiology of the cell. So here are some second messengers. So we'll fill in some of these gaps in your knowledge as we go through the whole class, right? Can't just do it all in one day. All right, but let's go to G proteins. All right, they're part of a second messenger pathway in many cells, and it's one of the oldest, it's the most highly conserved transduction scheme that we find in nature. Almost every living cell uses G proteins to allow for communication across the cell membrane. So how does a hydrophilic regulatory molecule make changes inside the cell? In many, many circumstances, it uses G proteins. And G proteins only contain 3 subunits. Right, so there's only 3 parts to a G protein. And when they become activated, they dissociate and they float around inside the cell membrane. They can actually float around over the whole cell membrane. And when they're floating around in the membrane and they bump into another kind of protein that has a receptor for the subunit of a G protein, then it can change the activity of the protein that's in the membrane. So if it's an ion channel, it can cause an ion channel to open, or it can cause it to close, changing the physiology of the cell. Or if a subunit of a G protein bumps into an enzyme, it can turn an enzyme on, or it can turn an enzyme off, which then can change the physiology inside the cell. So an enzyme can act like a switch on the plasma membrane to change the activity inside the cell. And you could think of it as what? A light switch on the room. All right, so if a G protein bumps into a light switch, maybe it's going to turn the light switch on. Could that change the activity inside this classroom? Sure, if I turn the light switch off, maybe a G protein will bump into a light switch and turn the light off. What's going to happen to this classroom? Well, you won't be able to take very good notes, for instance, right? So it's going to change the activity inside this classroom. So here is a nice signal transduction scheme that is done with a G protein. All right, so here's a G protein. We said it has 3 subunits. You could call it subunit 1, 2, and 3, but typically we call them alpha, beta, and gamma, just letters of the Greek alphabet. The alpha protein we see right here is the biggest one, but it is also one that can bind a high-energy nucleotide. Instead of ATP, it's guanosine triphosphate. It has the same energy properties as adenosine triphosphate, right? And it's going to bind to this alpha subunit right here. So here is the G protein. This G protein at the top of the page is associated with a receptor. And you can see that this receptor goes all the way across the plasma membrane. So here is an extracellular receptor binding site for the G protein coupled receptor complex. All right, so what kind of regulatory molecule is this? Could you describe any of the physical chemistry of this regulatory molecule right here? What's its nature? Yeah, it is a hydrophilic. It likes to be in water. It doesn't like to be through in lipid, so that's why this regulatory molecule is extracellular. It can't get through the cell membrane, right? So there has to be an extracellular receptor for it. All right, so when this regulatory molecule binds to the receptor protein, right, it changes a little bit of a conformation, and as long as there's GTP available inside the cell that activates this complex right here, then this complex can dissociate, right? And GDP is going to be released. GTP will then charge, will activate the system right here. And the alpha subunit, it will dissociate from the gamma and the beta subunit, and they're happy to be dissolved in the phospholipid bilayer. So these are hydrophobic proteins that can now wander around inside the cell membrane, because one model that we think of to describe the cell membrane is the fluid mosaic model, right? So this is like a fluid that these compounds can now move by diffusion from one area inside the plasma membrane to another. And in another location, we have other proteins embedded in the plasma membrane, and these, so there's going to be some hydrophobic amino acids in this region right here that allows this protein to dissolve in the plasma membrane. So this is what we're going to call an effector. And what's the responsibility of an effector? What does an effector do? It produces a response, right? That's what an effector does. It produces a response. So a muscle is an effector. It causes contraction. these effectors right here. Some examples could be enzymes. So when a G protein that dissociates like the beta and gamma bump into this enzyme right here, it can activate an enzyme, which then is going to build up some second messengers inside the cell. That's the effect of this beta and gamma subunit bumping into this enzyme right here. Or, for instance, maybe this effector right here will be an ion channel. And when the activated alpha unit bumps into it, it can open or close that ion channel. And if it's an ion channel for sodium, for instance, what's going to happen to sodium if the alpha subunit right here activates, opens up that channel? What's going to happen to sodium? It's going to go from the outside of the cell to the inside, changing what? The electrical properties of the cell. It's going to change the resting membrane potential. So what will happen to the resting membrane potential? Will it become more positive or negative? Okay, as the positive ion moves inside the cell, RMP becomes more positive, right? We call that depolarization. We're going to have to talk a couple more chapters about that, okay? So there's a change. There's one molecule outside the cell that changes a lot of physiology inside the cell because of this G protein. And then after these effectors are activated, the beta and gamma dissociate from that effector, the alpha dissociates from this effector, they join back up at the receptor molecule. Right, and in the process of doing that, the GTP, the high energy molecule, is hydrolyzed, it's broken apart. That energy then is used to form this activated complex right here that can be stimulated again by another regulatory molecule. So this is a nice cyclic kind of process, all right, and it's not free to the cell to turn these effectors on or off. What's the cost of turning these effectors on or off right here? One, yeah, because think of GTP as like being an ATP molecule. It does require some energy, right, in the form of guanosine triphosphate. That's just a nucleotide, just like ATP. All right, the other thing that I'll mention, and I'll mention again and again, is that here we see one regulatory molecule, and let's look at the magnitude inside the cell. If this is an ion channel, you don't have just one ion entering the cell. You have what? A big rush of ions. So even though you have one regulatory molecule, how many second messengers can then develop inside the cell? Many, hundreds or thousands, tens of thousands, right? So this is a scheme for amplification as well. So one signaling molecule trapped outside the cell can cause what? Thousands or tens of thousands of second messengers to build up inside the cell. So if you start with a very small signal and you end up with a huge signal, we call that, I'll just turn up the volume here, amplification. I didn't do it because I didn't want it to feedback. Okay. Same thing for an enzyme. If this enzyme gets turned on, it will convert a reactant into a product, but not just one product inside the cell, but again, thousands or tens of thousands of second messengers inside the cell. So again, that's a level of amplification. So that's why these G proteins are really handy. All right, so this is an exam figure. I'm not having you draw this in lab, but I am having you draw a figure in lab for extra credit. And so hopefully you got an email on that, and that is, which figure? Back a couple more. Was it in this chapter? I hope it was. Ah, right here. Okay, because here you go over, what, diffusion, facilitated diffusion, active transport. How many different kinds of active transport do you know of? Yeah, there's primary and secondary. You should know the difference between primary and secondary. You should know which way these molecules like to move just by diffusion. This slide right here has it all, including some little surface specializations right here that enhance transport across this membrane, because the bigger this membrane is, the more transporters you can have in there. And then the surface area increases to allow for increased diffusion, and that's what we're going to talk about in the next chapter. Okay? All right, so does anybody have any questions on chapter 6? Is this chapter 6? I think it is. Is this chapter 6? Okay. Okay. Really good. And I don't see any hands raised. So we are going to move on to the last chapter before the test, which is what? Mostly Chapter 3, which is mostly a review. And let's see, I need to get this off the screen, so I just have to blindly click. Oh, I can only open one at a time? I had it all set up. Okay, here it is. Let's go here, let's go here, 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 and there. All right, so this is just a really nice view from anatomy. Some of the pictures are a little bit different compared to your anatomy book, but you should be able to recognize all of these organelles by their shape and then have an understanding of what their function is. All right, like I see a mitochondria right here. What's the function of mitochondria? It makes ATP. Sometimes we call it the powerhouse of the cell. That's okay to think of it that way, but you should know that it makes ATP. We're going to learn a lot about mitochondria in the upcoming chapters. All right, so the first organelle that we usually talk about is the plasma membrane, right, that I see right here. It separates the living world of the inside of the cell from the non-living world that's outside the cell. It regulates what molecules move across in and out of the cell to maintain homeostasis inside the cell. All right, and this right here is what we call the structural and functional unit of life. If something is alive, it's got to be based on a cell. It's got to be made out of cells. That's all there's to it. So what does a cell have that makes it a cell? It's got to have a plasma membrane. Yeah, and it's got to have genetic material. Okay, in the cells that make up our body, that genetic material is found inside the nucleus. All right, some cells aren't sophisticated to actually have a nucleus, but they still have genetic material floating around inside the cell. That's fine for a living system. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the nucleus, but in our cells it does. All right, so everything inside the plasma membrane is what we call cytoplasm. All right, your book hasn't quite caught up to some of the modern nomenclature. But cytoplasm is all the living stuff inside the cell, and cytoplasm can be broken down into two main categories, which your book does just a little bit of a weak job on. The two categories that cytoplasm is made up of is organelles, like I see all these organelles. Some have membranes around them, like mitochondria, endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi body, and even the nucleus has a membrane around them. Those are organelles. Other kinds of organelles don't have a membrane, like centrioles right here and microtubules and microfilaments. But nonetheless, they're still organelles inside the cell. The second thing besides organelles that make up cytoplasm is something we call cytosol. And cytosol is the fluid part inside the cell, where all the solutes are dissolved in, enzymes are dissolved in the cytosol, and it's a living component of the cell as well. Okay. All right, so let's look at the plasma membrane. Well, we see the basic phospholipid bilayer, and this is a very fluid structure, right? So if we put a drop of oil on a glass of water, that oil is going to float on the surface of that glass of water, and if you jiggle that glass of water, what can you tell me about the oil? Is it going to fracture and break like a big iceberg or something, or what's it going to do if you jiggle that glass of water? It's going to just float right on the surface, right, and it's going to jiggle right on the surface of the water. It's not going to break apart or anything. So oil, like this phospholipid bilayer right here, is very fluid, right? And as a matter of fact, it's actually a little bit too fluid for living systems, because if you didn't have other components in the membrane, then probably our plasma membranes would just dribble right out on the floor. So some things that stabilize the phospholipid bilayer are these cholesterol molecules. Right, that kind of stabilizes it so that the membrane isn't too fluid. Right, and where do you find these cholesterol molecules? Near the phosphate group or near the fatty acid groups? Yeah, and does that make sense? Because the fatty acids are what? Hydrophobic, yeah, they're afraid of water, and steroids are hydrophobic as well. So that's exactly where they match up really, really nicely. So you do need cholesterol to stabilize the plasma membrane. And I see a lot of other structures embedded in the plasma membrane. So we have to advance our understanding of the fluid part of the phospholipid bilayer and realize other things are added to it. And so we should think of it like a puzzle, different pieces that are added to the membrane, right? And so that's the mosaic part of the fluid mosaic model that we should rely on for our understanding of the plasma membrane. And if we change the structure of the plasma membrane, guess what we're changing? We're going to change the function. All right, so let's talk about some of the functions of these other things that are added to the plasma membrane. They could be glycolipids. Glycolipids are part sugar molecules and part lipid, And because it's part lipid, right, it associates very easy with the plasma membrane. Here's a glycoprotein. And a glycoprotein is part sugar molecule. That's the glyco part of this word. And the other part is protein. So here's another combination kind of protein. Here's another glycolipid right here. Right? And then here is a protein that moves all the way across the plasma membrane. So this could be a good example of a channel or a gated channel that maybe opens or closes depending on maybe the electrical properties of the cell that allow material to move in and out by facilitated diffusion, for instance, like glucose or ions to change the resting membrane potential. Here is another kind of protein that we see moving across the cell membrane. So this can bind to microfilaments inside the cell. So microfilaments can pull and push on the plasma membrane to change the cell shape. Remember, some cells are columnar, some are squamous, some are cuboidal, and some are shapeshifters, like white blood cells. So microfilaments can actually pull or push on the plasma membrane right here to change its shape. All right, some of these right here have a specific branching pattern that I see. So these could be used as identifier or address molecules. We call these antigens. So that your immune system, when it ever bumps into a molecule that looks like a Y, it knows that that cell belongs to you. But if it bumps into an antigen that has maybe a different branching pattern, so it looks like a C or a B or a Z or something, what does your immune system know? That cell doesn't belong to you. And then it's a job of the immune system to become activated and design some kind of strategy to destroy that cell. And there's various ways of doing that. I think you'd spend a lot of time with that in a micro class. So you could look forward to that. So some of these other proteins are enzymes, for instance. So that can produce second messengers. So there are various kinds of proteins that are added to the basic phospholipid bilayer. So the plasma membrane is pretty special. So you got transporters, enzymes, receptors, and identity markers. Oh yeah, some of these could be also receptors. Okay. So for bulk transport, we talked about bulk transport before. Phagocytosis is a process where a plasma membrane will be deformed, form a little pocket right here, and an invagination and some kind of particle then will diffuse or move into this pocket, and the cell membrane then continues to surround this particle. We call that phagocytosis. This is a good way for white blood cells, okay, to get rid of viruses and bacteria. All right, then it will grab some of those antigens from that cell, and the white blood cell then will carry it to another germinal center in your body, like maybe a lymph node. And then the lymph node will design some kind of strategy to recognize that antigen easily and produce antibodies to kill any cell that has those kinds of antigens on its cell surface. All right, so phagocytosis is a process of what? Endocytosis of particles. And what is endocytosis of fluid called? Pinocytosis. And that's an active transport mechanism that requires ATP because all these microtubules and microfilaments have to push and pull to distort this membrane. Oh, we got it on the next slide right here. Pinocytosis is just non-specific intake of solutes inside the cell. All right, and exocytosis is just the reverse process. Okay, some surface specializations, cilia, are projections that or processes that come off of a cell. They're loaded with microtubules. And so inside of a cilia, you're going to have an arrangement of microtubules, and some of the microtubules on one side of the cilia will slide and expand. So what's going to happen to the cilia if one side grows a lot longer? What were to happen if my left leg was a lot shorter than my right leg? All right, I'm going to bend to that side. So the cilia is going to move back and forth. All right, so the function of cilia is motility. Some cells, some unicellular organisms move through their environment with cilia. None of the human cells do. They're kind of anchored into an epithelium. But nonetheless, if cilia are beating, what happens to the fluid that is above that epithelium? The fluid is going to move, right, for instance, or maybe a mucus lining is going to move. So you have a mucus lining because you have goblet cells that line your trachea. Those cells in your trachea have cilia. And so they're sweeping that mucus, which also traps dirt particles. Which way do those cilia move? Are they going to move down into your lungs, move mucus into your lungs, or move that mucus up out of your trachea? up and out of your body so that your lungs don't fill up with mucus. And then when it's up in your mouth, what do? Well, then you just swallow it down, okay? Please, unless you're a baseball player, then of course you can spit it out, okay? Flagella are sort of like cilia, but they're at least 10 times longer, but they're loaded with microtubules. And there is one human cell that has a flagellum, and it can swim around, and that is the sperm cell, right, for males. All right, so those are the only ways that cells can exhibit motility. Microvilli kind of looks like cilia, but not quite. It's still about a tenth the size of a cilia. They're very, very small. And we saw a picture of that on that diagram that you have to draw in lab. All right, so the function of microvilli is that it increases the surface area of the cell for transport across the cell membrane. So we call that absorption or membrane transport. So if you can picture that cell that has that nice wavy cell membrane just in one dimension, okay, what can you do to actually figure out, and it has a short length, right? What can you do to really understand surface area? You can take the endpoints of that membrane and stretch it out, right? Not so that you're stretching the membrane, but just so you're flattening all of the microvilli. And so now you have what, that same surface area, but the length is what? A lot longer, right? And that won't fit inside your body. So what has evolution figured out? Let's take that big surface area, that big length of the cell, fit it in a small space. What do? Well, just crinkle up the membrane, right? Put all those folds or convolutions in the membrane. And now you have a nice big surface area for exchange that fits into a small space. Okay. So here are some microtubules inside cilia, for instance. Okay, I don't think I even want to go over that, or that one. All right, cytoplasm and some organelles. All right, cytoplasm is made up of cytosol, which is the fluid part, as well as organelles. Those are the two components of cytoplasm. Inside the cell, you have a vast network of microfilaments and microtubules, and this is like the endoskeleton inside the cell. It gives the cell its shape. These are controlled by centrioles, or the centrosome complex. But another way you should think about this cytoskeleton is that organelles can attach to it, because there are a lot of organelles that have membranes that have those integrin proteins attached to the membranes of the organelles. They can be attached to motor proteins on the microfilaments right here in microtubules, and then organelles can actually be positioned within the cell. Right, so not only are the microtubules and microfilaments attached to the plasma membrane for cell shape, but they can also move organelles around inside the cell because they contain motor proteins. And so I like to think of these, the system in here is like being a monorail system, a railway system inside the cell where different components can move to one part of the cell to the other. Right, so not really two tracks, but one track. And where could you actually hop a ride on a monorail if you wanted to get from one place to another place? Okay, yeah, you'd have to go to Disneyland. I don't know any other place that has a monorail system. Okay, somebody might be thinking about putting them in, but there are plans, I'm sure. Okay, so what are some other organelles that we see? So here we see some microtubules. Here's the plasma membrane. I don't see any surface specializations on the cell. It's kind of a deficiency of this generalized cell right here. Okay, but your anatomy book has at least pictures of cilia and microvilli on them as well. All right, so what are some of these other things that we're going to look at? We have vesicles inside the cell. These are membrane-bound organelles. Membrane-bound just means that they have a membrane around them, and there are different kinds. Lysosome is one kind of vesicle. It contains an enzyme called lysozyme, and the job of lysozyme is that it's a digestive enzyme. So it will break complex molecules down into simpler molecules. And if a big system moves into the cell right here, like a bacterium, and it's deposited in this lysosome, what happens to the bacterium? It gets digested, so it can't be infectious. And then it gets broken down into its building blocks. Like, what's the building block of a protein that a bacterium is made out of? Amino acids. And what can your cells do with amino acids? It can build some other proteins that it needs, right? So the lysosome is an intracellular digestive system. It's used for digesting macromolecules or even other foreign cells, right, down into various building blocks. There's some other vesicles in here. Not really labeled, they're still colored the same, but let's go over those. There's something called a peroxisome, and it's going to look very much like a lysosome, but it doesn't contain lysozyme. It contains peroxidase, and I maybe have a cell. Oh, here, a slide on that. Peroxisome right here. All right, and a peroxisome is something that can break toxic chemicals down. Like hydrogen peroxide can be broken down into water and oxygen, which are not toxic under most circumstances. So the key term for peroxisome is detoxification. All right, a lysosome would be digestion. Right, so it's really nice if you have like a bullet point in your mind to describe the function of these various kinds of vesicles. All right, there's another one that I don't have a slide for. I have it someplace. All right, it's an endosome. Endosome. Oh, we talked about that. An endosome contains membrane transporters, like a glucose transporter. So if here is an endosome, and it's inside the cell, it might have some kind of transporter right here. Then here's a plasma membrane. So at this point, this plasma membrane cannot allow glucose to move across the membrane, but with a proper signal, then this endosome moves over to the plasma membrane and inserts these transporters into the plasma membrane so glucose can enter the cell. So glucose can enter. All right, so when I think of an endosome, I think of routing. All right, so it can control where these specific membrane components are located. Inside the cell, they are what? Inactive. And when they're in the plasma membrane, they can become active. All right, so an endosome participates in that active control of various substances across the membrane. A good notable example would be glucose in this particular case. Okay, so three kinds of vesicles. Here's another organelle, the mitochondria. A nice illustration. We see it has an outer membrane. It also has an inner membrane. It's got all kinds of compartments on the inside. So sometimes that inner membrane we call the Christi membrane. And if we look at this mitochondria right here, just by its shape, it has the right size and shape to be kind of recognized as a bacterium. Right? And a bacteria is alive because it has cytoplasm. So I see cytoplasm right here. But in order for it to be alive, what else does this little membrane-enclosed particle have to have? It has to have DNA. That's right. It's got to have genetic material. Now, mitochondria doesn't have a nucleus, but it does have a chromosome. Right? So it obeys all of the standalone features for a cell. So it is basically a living cell that at one time we think infected a cell that had a nucleus, and they learned to live together. Right, so it wasn't killed, wasn't rejected, because it provides something very important for the cell, and that is ATP. Okay, so it's a nice symbiosis because we get ATP from this organelle right here. Now, why is the mitochondria happy to live inside our cells? It's got to get something too, in order for it to be a true symbiosis. Okay, we give it oxygen all the time. It needs oxygen to make ATP. The other thing is, too, is that since it's a living cell, other organisms would like to ingest and digest it for amino acids and lipids and energy, right? So if it's inside our cells, guess what it gets? Protection. It gets our immune system, right? Protection from other kinds of viruses that maybe want to infect it, or other bacteria, or other kinds of helpful processes. So we get oxygen. We get ATP from it, and mitochondria get oxygen and the components to make ATP, namely glucose, which will keep this mitochondria alive. All right, so we call that the endosymbiont theory of this organelle living inside our cells. Okay, here's another organelle, really blown up. This is just a computer model of a ribosome. Ribosome has two subunits. It also has a tunnel going through it, and the ribosome is necessary to make a protein. Right? So you need ribosomes to make proteins. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in the class. On the diagram that we have, all right, so here's a nice electron micrograph. We see these little dots. We see little dots on the surface of the nucleus. These are membrane-bound ribosomes. Here is endoplasmic reticulum that has a lot of ribosomes on it. So what can this particular kind of endoplasmic reticulum make? This is what we call rough ER because it has ribosomes attached to it. Rough ER is for protein synthesis because it has ribosomes. We see other ribosomes floating in the cytoplasm. Those are free ribosomes, and they make proteins as well. All right, so the proteins that are made by rough ER are destined to end up inside of a vesicle. All right, so these things could be used, rough ER is used to make proteins that might find their way outside of the cell or end up in vesicles inside the cell. Proteins that are free in the cytosol make proteins that just stay inside the cell. They're not destined to be excreted. All right, so rough ER is part of what we call the secretory pathway sometimes as well. All right, but if I ask what's the function of rough ER, you're going to say protein synthesis. And to help understand that is why? Because it has a special little structure called a ribosome, which is the workbench for making a protein. Other kinds of endoplasmic reticulum in your body does not have ribosomes, so can it make a protein? No, can't make a protein. So smooth ER is, the job of smooth ER is lipid synthesis. Phospholipids and steroids are made in smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Here's that secretory pathway. We have the nucleus, right? And then we have rough endoplasmic reticulum right here, which is making a protein. That protein then, once it's made, finds its way into a vesicle which pinches off from the endoplasmic reticulum and then hops a ride on the microtubule system to a Golgi apparatus right here. And let's talk about the function of Golgi apparatus. There's two words to characterize Golgi apparatus. The protein enters the Golgi apparatus and it's modified. It's conjugated with another kind of molecule. Maybe that protein is conjugated with a lipid, makes a protein lipid molecule. Or it's conjugated with a glucose and becomes a glycoprotein. A notable example would be mucus is a glycoprotein. All right, that modified molecule then gets packaged in another vesicle and it hops a ride on that microtubule system, maybe moves over to the plasma membrane, so the interior contents of that vesicle then is exocytosed into the extracellular space. So that is what we call the secretory process right here for proteins that are made by rough ER. All right, another fate for a protein made by rough ER is maybe it's going to be in this lysosome right here, and so maybe rough ER makes lysozyme as well. All right, but those proteins never end up floating freely in the cytosol. So these are the two possible fates of proteins made by rough ER. Secretion is one, or staying inside of a vesicle inside the cell. So the job of Golgi is twofold. It's number one, modification, and number two, packaging. Packaging into vesicles that are either destined to be released outside the cell or stay inside the cell. So modification and packaging for a Golgi apparatus. And you can kind of always see Golgi apparatus because they bend away from the bending of the nucleus. Can you see it bending away? While endoplasmic reticulum always follows the shape of the nucleus, bends around the nucleus. All right, so that's the Golgi complex. What other kinds of organelles are there? I want to go back to that picture of a slide, the cell right here. I think that pretty much covers it. You got a number of different vesicles. You got mitochondria for making ATP, smooth ER for lipid synthesis, rough ER for protein synthesis, microtubules give you cell shape, right? And also for, it moves things around inside the cell. Don't forget about things that aren't on this diagram, like microvilli for absorption, cilia for motility, flagella for motility. Okay, now you might be wondering, why does a nice advanced cell like a human cell have all of these organelles in here? Why are there many organelles inside the cell? Seems like a lot of work to have all these organelles right there, but a very important reason. Anybody think of a good reason? Okay. Yeah, because all these organelles have a different shape, which means they have a different function, and we just went over the functions. More importantly, right, the reason why is let's consider this building as an example. Okay. So when you walk into this building, I have a fantastic idea. Instead of having all these rooms, which are really confusing to find, let's just have one big room inside the SEM building. And I think this is really great, and I want to sell you this idea. Because if it just had one room with a bunch of chairs, you could come in the building and you could listen to a physics lecture. You could listen to a math lecture. You could listen to biology and anatomy all at the same time, and you could graduate in one semester. Would that be great? If it was just one room. And people are saying, you don't like my idea. Okay, I'm not going to run for president. You don't like my idea. Why is that? Because when you listen to anatomy lecture, that would interfere with the physiology and chemistry and math and geology lecture, right? So the reason why we put different rooms in a building is so that all of those things can happen in one building at exactly the same time without what? Without interference, right? So that's the same thing with these organelles. They have special functions, like making ATP right here from this mitochondria. But if there were digestive enzymes floating around, right, that would interfere with the job of the mitochondria. They would digest the mitochondria down, right? So these organelles are inside the cell so that all kinds of different functions can happen inside the cell at the exact same time without interfering with other functions, other important functions that the cell has to perform at the same time, just like rooms inside the building. Okay. Well, here's an organelle that I forgot to mention. Centrioles. They come together. They form a centrosome. They organize the microtubule system inside the cell, right? And so they can direct the activity of where these organelles should be positioned and even the position of chromosomes during mitosis, right? So centrioles can even then help determine what the shape of the cell is or if the cell is a shapeshifter or whatever. So that's what their job is right there. Okay. The nucleus, that's the last thing. That's a very important organelle. It contains genetic material, and it's inside of a membrane. It has actually two walls associated with it. All right, and so what's the job of this membrane? Again, it helps protect, right? It allows the whatever is happening inside the nucleus, it protects it from everything else that's happening outside, all right, in the cytoplasm. And there are many things that can destroy the genetic material inside this nucleus right here. And, for instance, what the heck is this genetic material used for? It determines, it's a blueprint on how to make the cell, right? So if it's a blueprint on how to make the structure of the cell, what else is it doing? It determines the function of the cell, right? So it determines the structure and function of the cell. And if that information is lost, what happens to the cell? It dies because it doesn't know how to rebuild itself, doesn't know how to control itself. Right, so this information is very, very important and shouldn't be just floating out in the cytoplasm because it can be damaged. So it's not like a computer program that you have in your computer. If your computer program gets corrupted, you can always reload software in your computer. But the cell, if this information becomes corrupted, it can't get more genetic material. The cell is just destined to die as a result of that. So there's DNA inside the cell, and that's the genetic material that defines all the living processes of this particular cell. All right, so that's the job of the nucleus. Now, the nuclear membrane can disappear at certain times, but there's something special that has to happen to the DNA. All right, and we're going to talk about that later on in this particular chapter. All right, so we have DNA. Where do we find DNA? Inside the nucleus. Okay, so here is, right, what we call the central dogma of biology. And we're beginning not to even teach this very much because a dogma is just something that you should believe in, right, and you should never question, all right? And does that sound like science to you? No, you should always question information in science. You should always question authority in science, right? You shouldn't just believe something. You should prove it under which circumstances is that information correct or incorrect, right? But this is a really good place to start with your understanding on something we call protein synthesis. All right, so here's a diagram that you shouldn't really question, but of course, as you go on, you will question some of these things. All right, so to make a protein, how many step process do you see on this slide right here? How many arrows do you see? You see two. So it's a two-step process, right? All right, and so the process right here that we're looking at is the flow of information. Information is going to flow from DNA, which is located in the nucleus. That information is going to be converted into RNA. All right, and then that information is going to move out into the cytoplasm through some of those pores that we saw, or through some active transport mechanisms through the nuclear membrane. And then the RNA can be used to make a protein. All right, so information always flows from DNA into RNA and then RNA into protein. All right, never the reverse. That's the dogma. And of course, what can you tell me about rules? There's always some exceptions, but limited exceptions to these rules. But I want you to know these rules to begin with. Okay, so it's a two-step process. And you should be able to name these two different processes. The first step right here is what we call transcription. The second process right here is what we call translation. All right, and let's just kind of look and see why that is. I'm going to, I guess, talk about this slide while showing this one right here. Okay. What's the building block of DNA? Nucleotide. What's the building block of RNA? Nucleotide, right? It's the same building block. So the language of DNA and the language of RNA is exactly the same, right, with some modifications. There's one nucleotide that has an oxygen, there's another one that doesn't. Not a big difference, right, in terms of our understanding, but the building block is exactly the same. So where does transcription take place? Because where do you find DNA? It's always in the nucleus. So transcription always happens inside the nucleus. Then RNA will move outside, okay, the nucleus. And the second step is called translation. Why do we call that translation? What does translation mean? Yeah, take it from one language to another. Like Farsi to Arabic, or English to German. Now, what about if you have a translator that's going to translate your English into German, should they change the information? Just the language. The information should be exactly the same, right? Okay. So we call this translation right here because the language is different. What's the language of a protein? Or maybe another way of thinking of that, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. So this is an amino acid language. What's the language of RNA? Yeah, nucleic acids, right? Nucleotides. So it's going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language, so that is translation. What about the information content? Should be exactly the same, right? No, just the language changes. Now, why do we call this transcription, going from DNA to RNA? You're familiar with that already. You probably don't have to look that up in the dictionary, but you could if you want to be really familiar with it, because maybe you're going to apply for a job or another college or another program within this college. What do they ask for? A transcript. What's a transcript? It's just like a photocopy of all your records within the college. So it's an exact duplicate. Is the language the same or different? The language is exactly the same. What about the information content? Exactly the same. It's just a nice photocopy, right? So because it's the same language, we can't call that translation, since it's just a photocopy. RNA is basically a photocopy of the DNA that's inside the nucleus. So that's really nice transcription. Okay. All right. And these arrows right here, is it a two-way arrow or a one-way arrow? One-way arrow. So information always flows from DNA into RNA and protein. Right. So proteins are made by the direction of DNA. Right. And proteins don't make DNA. DNA makes proteins, right? So it's a nice one-way street. You might have to change your opinion on that in a little bit. Maybe we can talk about some specific examples a little bit later on. So DNA directs the production of proteins, never the reverse. And why is that really handy at first thought? Why is it really great that proteins cannot change your DNA? You don't want your DNA to change. For instance, if you go home tonight and have a nice chicken dinner, you don't have to worry about waking up in the morning with feathers or a beak, okay? Because of this central dogma in biology right here. Some circumstances maybe are exceptions that we'll talk about. They're very interesting. All right, so a nice synopsis of this is that protein synthesis is a two-step process. The first step is transcription. DNA is converted into RNA. And where does that happen? Always inside the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm, okay, because there are genes inside DNA right here, and a gene is just a specific sequence of nucleotides that will determine a specific sequence of amino acids to make a protein, right? So a gene is like the dictionary that tells you how to spell out a protein in terms of what amino acids go at what position. Oh, what do we call that? What do we call that? Sequence of amino acids in a protein. Primary sequence. That's right, the primary sequence. So the primary sequence, let's use that. The primary sequence of a protein is determined by the primary sequence of nucleotides in DNA, right? And if you know the primary structure of a protein, then what? That determines the secondary structure, tertiary structure, which then determines how that protein is going to function in your body. Okay. Second step of protein synthesis is translation. And that's where information in RNA is used to make a protein. So there is the primary structure of nucleotides, and RNA is used to actually determine the primary structure of a protein. And where does this happen? Where does translation happen? In the cytoplasm. Because what do you have in the cytoplasm that allows a protein to be made? Where do you find the workbench for protein synthesis? What is the workbench for protein synthesis? That's the ribosome, right? Okay, so now you saw you had free ribosomes and ribosomes attached to endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so that's pretty nice for you to know. Here's just a little caveat. We do know that some viruses, or now viruses don't have cytoplasm, so can a virus be alive? No, right? It has a nice protein coat, really doesn't have a membrane. Some viruses have a membrane. Okay, but they don't have cytoplasm. So if a virus doesn't have cytoplasm, is it alive? Is it a living system? No, it's just a little particle, and it's an infectious particle. Because inside a virus, it can have DNA, and that DNA gets injected into the cell, and then it redirects the activity of the cell because of that new set of information, right? And it can make new viruses. All right, some viruses don't have DNA. They actually have RNA inside of them. And then they also have a protein that can take RNA and make DNA out of it. What do we call that process, DNA being converted into RNA? Transcription. Some viruses have an enzyme that can convert RNA to DNA. We call that a reverse transcriptase. All right, so here's a little violation to the central dogma right here. All right, so transcription sometimes can run backwards, but does that maintain homeostasis in your body? No, right? That's a disease process. So we call those retroviruses, and sometimes they're really tricky. HIV is one example of a retrovirus. Okay, maybe we'll talk about a violation of this step right here, translation, later on in the class. Okay, genes are lengths of DNA that code for the synthesis of RNA, all right? And one kind of RNA is messenger RNA. That's really the dictionary, determines the primary sequence of a particular protein. And that's transported out of the nucleus to ribosomes where proteins are made. All right, so this, we talked about this already, transcription and translation. All right, the dark areas inside the nucleus, you can consider that like a little organelle inside the nucleus. All right, that's the active part of the nucleus. That's where ribosomal RNA is being made. And ribosomal RNA is the kind of RNA that is used to make a ribosome. If we count all the genes inside the nucleus, all right, and know what they make, we call that the genome of the cell, all right, or of a particular line of cells, maybe cells that make up the human body. And these genes are used to make proteins. So if we look at all the proteins that a human cell can make, we call that the proteome. If you have a list of all the proteins that you can possibly make, that's the proteome. And the proteome is dependent on what? The genome, right? Because it's genes that produce proteins, and according to the central dogma, not the reverse, right? Okay, so let's look at some of the structures, okay, of a chromosome. Chromosome is made out of chromatin. And chromatin has two main components to it. It has DNA, which is a nucleic acid, and it also has proteins. So let's look at that. So this blue, is that blue? That, to me, it looks like blue. That is a nucleic acid, that's DNA, all right? But it's also wrapped around a protein. This is a histone protein molecule. So chromatin is part DNA and part protein. And it's packaged because this nucleic acid is extremely long. If we were to take the DNA out of your cells and string it from end to end, does anybody have a sense or a feeling of how long that would be? That would be 250,000 miles, which would take you to the moon, right? So that's a really big distance. Well, how do you take a big, long molecule like that or a series of molecules and fit it inside your body? Just like microvilli, what do? You fold it up, right? You package it up. So that's what a chromosome does. It's made out of chromatin, which is part nucleic acid, DNA, and histones, and it winds the DNA around this histone, and then the histones are packaged and coiled some more, so it's super twisted. If you have DNA with a histone, we call that a nucleosome. All right, and then all of this is wound up even with some more proteins, which makes a chromosome. So a chromosome is just an incredibly long filament of chromatin that has been coiled and supercoiled. And this molecule is so big that you can even see it underneath a microscope. All right, so this right here is what we call condensed chromatin. And over here we see extended chromatin. It's unwound from the chromosome, and portions of it are unwound from the nucleosome. All right, so how do we want to consider extended chromatin from condensed? If it's condensed in a chromosome, it's very safe. It's not very fragile. It can't be broken, which is important, because if we break a DNA molecule, then we lose the primary sequence of nucleotides in that chromosome, which means then it can't be used to make a protein, which then means that function of that protein will be missing from your cell. So the cell is going to die as a result of that. So when chromatin is condensed, it's very safe. It can't be broken. When it's extended, it's in a relatively delicate, fragile form. It can be broken, but this is the only form that can be used by the cell to make proteins. Condensed chromatin can't be used for transcription, only extended chromatin. So I tend to think of this condensed chromatin as being a suitcase when I'm going on vacation. So when I'm going to fly to Denpasar. I'm going to do some scuba diving. I'm going to do some surfing. I'm going to hang out at the local bar. So what do I need? I need my sunglasses, right? I need my bathing suit. I need some nice fancy dress-up clothes, toothbrush, hair. I need my regulator, my surfboard. Do I walk onto the plane with all that stuff in my arms? Because what's going to happen? I'm going to forget something. I'm going to lose it. It's going to get broken, right? So I take all of that stuff and I put it in a suitcase, right? So now it's safe and protected. It's going to get to where I'm going to go. But when it's in the suitcase, can I use it? No. So here is condensed chromatin. It's protected, but it can't be used. Right? I get to where I'm going. What do? Unpack my suitcase, right? I have all of that functional material. Now I can do all that cool stuff. But it's going to be scattered. I might lose some. So when it's in an extended form, it can be damaged. But if I haven't damaged it yet, I can still use it. Right, so that's the trade-off between extended and condensed chromatin. All right, so your book calls euchromatin part of a chromosome that's active in transcription. I call that extended chromatin. All right, your book calls heterochromatin highly condensed region. All right, so there's a little bit of difference between heterochromatin and condensed chromatin. Heterochromatin, according to your book, you might have to change your opinion on this later on, is permanently inactivated. So heterochromatin can never be used by that cell again to make a protein. And as a matter of fact, you might even pass that on to your offspring, right? So there might be a gene or a set of genes in your body due to various environmental factors or other kinds of conditions that become permanently inactivated, and it might be inheritable. We don't really know for how many generations that is. So that's interesting that our behaviors might affect what our children have, all right? And it's darker in color. Now, heterochromatin is not really condensed chromatin, because condensed chromatin can go from, extended to condensed and then back and forth. And that's what this slide shows right here, how condensed chromatin can become activated. And it's by a process of acetylation. So acetylation, when histones become acetylated, condensed chromatin goes to an extended form, and then it can be read out by transcription to make a protein, and when it's deacetylated, it goes back to a safe form or a condensed form. And acetyl, how many carbons does glucose have? 6. All right, and an acetyl group has 2. So you can make 3 acetyl groups from 1 glucose molecule. So it's related that way in terms of its carbon backbone. So it's a very common kind of compound that we have in our body. And there's an enzyme that's used to regulate transcription by acetylating chromatin or deacetylating it right here. All right, so we're going to start next time with RNA synthesis. What's the building block of RNA?
Nucleotides.
That's right. So go back and look at some nucleotides that you find in RNA. When's your test? Week from today. Oh, Monday, don't forget, is a holiday. So you can't get into the library, or nobody will be here to answer questions for you on Monday.